On this episode of the Africa Whisperer.
They were on a mission to empower me, right? But at the time when all of that was happening, there was a lot of breakdown, even in my personal life. It was just a moment where everything just crashed. And looking back now, I know why it happened. But when it happened, I was just like, what in the world is happening?
Hey, I'm Lee Kasumba, and this is our journey across Africa, navigating the intricate landscapes of business, culture, and global influence from the African perspective.
I'm just, first of all, really proud of you, Nomdeni, and all the work you've achieved. Like, I've been watching you and I'm just like, wow, I just can't believe. On one hand, I can't believe how far you've gone. But on the other hand, I can absolutely believe it. Like, absolutely. There's no shock. I'm like, but of course. So I've prepared a bit of an introduction. You know, let's see if we can get through this interview without tears and with lots of inspiration. Yes. So I thought of many ways to introduce my guest on this episode of the Africa Whisperer. And yes, she has an impressive resume and body of work. She's been able to commercialize purpose while building a global movement. CEO and founder of a media marketing agency, Agenda Woman, a lady that is literally obsessed with women and finding ways to make their journey in success a little easier. She's a little bit tough when it comes to business, but she's extremely vulnerable when it comes to sharing her story and sharing her purpose. She understands and is unashamed about the value and importance of money. She's the queen of curation, even in real life, when she's not in front of cameras. She's definitely the queen of curation. She curates energy in rooms that she steps in, movements, spaces, and businesses. But perhaps the best way to describe Nomdeni is in her own words. Nothing gives me joy like fundamentally knowing that I hold the power to curate my life. You know, when you've hit the bottom and you've been able to come up, there's something magical that comes from the bottom. Nomdeni Mdaka. Welcome, Mdaki. Sorry, welcome. Imagine, I even said your name wrong by mistake.
That was so amazing. That was so amazing. Only a friend can introduce me like that. And that was, I think, it's the beginning of the year and it's so nice to kind of, it's reflective. Thank you. Thank you for that beautiful intro.
Yeah. I'm hoping that the audiences are going to be able to gauge just a little bit of who you are outside of the amazing achievements that you've had with Agenda Woman. We'll get into all of that, you know, edits, the work you've done before with Galawa, with DJ, like all of that. There's so many things that you've done, but I really want to go back to the beginning of your story, right? Because, what I love about speaking to, I love speaking to different people, but speaking to South Africans specifically is I love talking to people who've lived between the two South Africas, you know, pre 1994 and post 1994. So you're, you were raised in the 80s, though you look 20. And, and you literally come from a family that can be described as having black wealth. So can you paint a picture, for people, like what your upbringing was like and specifically what black wealth looked like during apartheid time while you were growing up?
Well, firstly, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you because I think you're so amazing at having conversations and it's such an honor to be able to share my story on your platform. I am turning 40 this year. Can you believe it? I am going to be 40 in July. Hey. It's so, so crazy. But what an awesome life I've lived till now. And I'm so excited about the years that are coming. So I was born in a small town in KwaZulu-Natal, which is a province in South Africa. It's not the glamorous Johannesburg or Cape Town. It is KwaZulu-Natal, which is more family grounded. You know, it's a bit slower. But there are towns leading up to a big city in KwaZulu-Natal called Durban. And I was in a small town called Newcastle where I was born to a family of entrepreneurs. It's always interesting when I think about how I see my life in hindsight versus what I knew when I was young. I didn't know what entrepreneurship was. All I knew was my grandparents left home extremely early, around like 5, and they went to the shops that they owned to open up the shops, and they stayed there until very late, and then they came back in the evening. We also had a massive house, and I didn't also realize what that was about because that's all I knew. So my grandparents had managed to build a 24-room house. It was 12 bedrooms, 5 bathrooms, massive kitchen, 3 lounges, and that's all I knew up until my much later in life when I had to rent a townhouse in Johannesburg. And I was like, this was different. But of course, also moving to university. So my grandparents, my grandfather is from Pretoria, actually, which is a city just outside Johannesburg. And my grandmother is from Johannesburg in Soweto, in a region. I don't know, what do we call it when you're in Soweto? And then there's like, it's not a suburb, but in Soweto in White City. So my grandmother studied nursing. My grandfather actually started his businesses when he had met my grandmother. But my grandfather only had like a grade four education, which was standard two at the time. Not really sure how to unpack it for the rest of the world. But he didn't really have extensive education, but they were able with my grandmother to come together. And it literally started off as a small stall at the corner in Pretoria, Mamelodi, where they would sell, like, you know, the usual vegetables and all of that stuff. They moved on to then own a shop in Mamelodi, Pretoria. But around apartheid, particularly the 70s, there was a lot of uprising, and they would always find themselves, you know, a victim of the uprising because their shop would get burnt a lot. So they were incurring losses and they always had to kind of get new stock, fix the shop. And it was really taking a toll on their business at the time. My grandfather meets a friend, the surname is Sithole, another gentleman who was also a Sithole, who kind of, I guess, gravitated towards him on the basis that they share the surname, and told him about a small town in KZN called Newcastle. So around 1979, that's when they leave Pretoria and they migrate to Newcastle to then continue to build their businesses. I know you don't even know the story. I haven't told
you. I thought you were from KZN like that. So that's crazy.
No. Wow. Okay. So the origins for the family is actually in Pretoria. So then they migrate to Newcastle, which is around 1979, and they start to build their businesses. So Black wealth in South Africa at the time was owning grocery outlets, if I can call it that, and multiple outlets. This serviced really the Black community because there wasn't a lot of traveling into the white areas. So somehow, because of the pass laws and the apartheid laws, you needed to stay in the place where your home was, and you were not really allowed to roam around and do all kinds of things that we get to do now. So they, I guess, in a way, saw an opportunity in that dilemma. And we all understood that the wealthy in our townships were people who owned the shops where we bought our groceries, because there was no like ShopRite and the big grocery stores. They were the place where we got our groceries. So they and the richer ones would always have like a line of stores. Like they would get property where one is a supermarket, and then there's a dry cleaners next to the dry cleaners. Then there's a butchery, and then there was always like a cafe type where you would get all your junk food and that kind of thing. So they had quite a lot of those in Newcastle, particularly in the township Matadeni and Osizweni. And then they went on to also open a hotel. So the hotel in Matadeni was owned by my grandparents. It was so interesting.
That's incredible.
It was so interesting with like my last venture. I got a DM from someone who said, oh my gosh, you are literally a representation of what you're. And someone sent me a DM and they were like, you're such a representation of what your grandparents stood for. The hotel, when it was owned by them in Ematadeni, was just a reflection of excellence. Everything they did was excellent. The maintenance, in any way that they ran their business, they were always just a representation of excellence. So that was my grandparents. So quickly in the interview. Yeah. My gosh.
I'm also just like trying, you know, I'm Nomdeni. There were so many things that you said that I wanted to touch on, but I think that, you know, one of the most powerful things is that, you know, sometimes, you know, when people talk about how you stand on the shoulders of your ancestors, whether you know it or not, there's some things that are just passed down. And often as, you know, as African people, we don't realize how many generational blessings are being passed down. And it's literally like, you know, from your grandparents and them being in apartheid South Africa and all of those situations that we're dealing with, that spirit of excellence has literally been passed down to you. I hope you know how powerful that is. You know, it's like we need to celebrate that. You know, that's incredible. And I think also when I think about that, you know, when we're looking now, it makes me think of how powerful even just we are as communities. You know, obviously in South Africa, there's a lot of talk about the township economy. and, you know, how we can actually service each other and people can generate wealth. There are creative ways of generating wealth, which is basically what you're doing also in your business, you know? So I think it's so full circle. We could end the conversation here. I say, yeah, I've learned everything.
It's absolutely full circle. I mean, I don't want to jump into the project, but I remember on the first day of the project launching, I just stood there and I thought to myself, this is everything I think they would have become if they lived today, you know, because in a way with the limitations that they had, they did the best that was possible at the time. And to be turning 40 and have gone through so many trials and so many things and find myself in a place where I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is what they probably would have become or stood for, or even greater, you know, because they were much, much, much more excellent, I think, than where I am now. And it's one of those moments that you can never explain. But I think anyone who lives through a lineage of people who really did well, and you find yourself in a place where you're just like, oh my gosh, I have become the thing that I was, I guess, maybe born to become, or always what they saw I could become. It was something.
It speaks so much to legacy and to destiny and purpose. I love it. Like, your whole life story really speaks to that. And just to touch a bit with regards to your family, you know, I know that you're somebody who's experienced quite a lot of loss. You know, it's obvious when you were speaking about your grandparents, you were really emotional and you mentioned about how, you know, they've passed on. For you, you experienced quite a bit of loss. What, and even up until recently, I'm really sorry about the loss of your younger brother. But what do you think that loss, and for people who are that close to you, what has it taught you about life? Like, what is death and people passing on? What has it taught you about life and who you are?
I think I've interfaced with potentially all the faces of grief, right? When I was young, the first loss that we experienced as a family, so my grandparents had 8 kids, which were my uncles and aunts. And these are my maternal grandparents, because I was raised at my mother's home. So the first loss was around 1991, and it was one of my uncles. But at the time, I was probably like 6. So I remember, you know, a funeral taking place. I remember my grandmother's pain to some degree, but I was 6. But I still quite remember a little bit of that. And then when I was 15 was, I think, the extensive loss that we experienced, because the first loss was my other uncle. So out of the 8 kids, my grandmother told me that I think there was one stillbirth, and then it was my one uncle in 1991, and it was still heavy apartheid South Africa. And then in 1999, I then lost my other uncle. So then my grandmother's left with 5 kids. And that was interesting, because it was the first time there was a loss and I could understand that something's happened. And I remember my mother, I think, fetching me at school. I was in grade 11. It was like my second last year before I leave high school and going home. And I still remember the somberness and that feeling. And what was interesting is that the night my uncle died, he actually called out to me. And I was a kid, and he had been sick for 2 years. So we were always avoiding him, you know, as kids, which is like, oh, no, he's going to send me. I want to sleep. And he passed on that night. And I remember my grandmother saying he just wanted to speak to me about how I should carry myself as a woman. And I didn't really carry that with me. I was young. I think I was very young. So I didn't really take it into heart. I understand it now. I understand the conversation he wanted to have with me. And then 6 months after that, we lost my other uncle in the same house. You remember, we all live in the same house because it's a massive house. So everyone has rooms in this house. So I was in the house that day when my other uncle died 6 months later. He was upstairs and he had a stroke. And all I remember is my grandmother's like loud scream. I'd never heard my grandmother cry until that time. And, that was tough. That was in the same year. And then the following year, I remember my other uncle saying to us, we were sitting in the kitchen when the first funeral took place. And he said to us, I'm definitely going to die. I'm definitely next, you know? And it's still so eerie when you think about it. But then 6 months after the second death, he died. So, that was 99, 2000. And, I remember, you know, getting a lot of, you know, people will tell you all kinds of things around what's happening, why it's happening and all of that. But I kind of still felt grounded. My grandmother was my anchor. You know, my grandmother took me to church. I was raised in a Christian family. If I could see her, I knew that everything was still okay, right? Mm-hmm. Although she was in a lot of pain, but I could just see her. You know, she was just always this pillar of strength and always someone I could look at and know that, okay, life is still okay. There's a lot going on, but we're okay. And then in 2000, I matriculated and I came to Johannesburg for university. And my first year in 2001, I got the call that my grandfather had died. What was interesting is I had seen him before he died, and he said to me, oh my gosh, you're so beautiful. Someone needs to pay Lobola for you now, meaning, you know, someone needs to marry me. And my grandmother, I remember, was teasing him and saying he likes money. You know, he was a businessman. So he was like, you like money, now you want to sell off the child. And that was the last time I saw him. And I still remember how him calling me beautiful was the first time I actually thought of myself as a beautiful person, because I'd grew up my entire life thinking I'm smart and you can't argue with me on that. But beauty was not a thing I upheld until he said it to me. Then I thought, oh, I think I'm maybe a beautiful girl now. And he passed on in 2001. And you must remember, we're in a small town, we're a dominant family. So all these funerals are just packed with thousands of people, you know, who want to come and just... Yeah. Pay their respects. So my grandfather's funeral was like that. I mean, he'd done a lot for the town. And but still my grandmother was there, you know. So she was always that person I knew. If she's here, it's okay. And then unfortunately in 2003, my grandmother dies. And I think that was extremely painful. That was the first time I went to therapy, because I could accept it when it happened, because I thought, well, maybe she's an old lady. But in hindsight, she was in her 60s. But for me, she was my grandmother. So wow. I thought she's an old lady. Yeah. That was really, really hard. That was the first time I went to therapy. And that was the first time I kind of started to unpack the impact of all the other deaths. And after my grandmother's death, we didn't really have a home because she was the only one left. So it was the beginning of a lot of breaking apart of the family structure. We didn't have someone that we were looking up to. Everyone in some way that is would take the whole interview to explain went into their own worlds. And I don't remember my family much around that time. And I was at school. I didn't have a place to go back to, you know, because I stayed at the residences at school. It was really, really, really hard. I don't know. And now, you know, with my brother's passing, that was also very different. That was, it's the kind of pain that I don't think I'll ever be able to explain. I was just saying to someone, even this weekend, I had a really tough weekend because suddenly it came up, you know. And it's something you learn to live with. It's something that somehow is always painful in some place in your heart. But I think the thing about my family that I always stand on is just how much we were able to do and how much we were able to build a name for ourselves in the short time that everyone was here. And, you know, I feel protected. I feel watched over. I feel the strength and the might of their presence in my life till today. So it's a very tricky thing to really unpack and better understand. But that really was the series of losses that I've experienced until the loss of my brother last year. It's really hard for anyone who has lost people that they love. It's hard. You live with it. And in moments when it comes up, you just surrender to it and you keep moving forward and you do your best to live your life the best way that you can.
Nomdeni, I, you know, based on all of the, you know, the losses and dealing with grief, you know, do you think that losing your family and your grandmother and just the, you know, the family going from being really united to everybody being in their separate ways after, you know, your grandmother had passed away, do you feel that is somehow part of the reason that you've been, you know, that you've been able to propel yourself into success, because it's something that you can control?
That's such an interesting observation, Lee. I remember someone saying to me a couple of, I think in every phase of my life, someone is unpacking what is going on. It was interesting even in December, you know, because I was interfacing with a lot of people who have followed my journey or some part of my journey, and they're always giving you feedback around what they are seeing versus what I'm experiencing. I remember there was a part in my life where everyone was like, a lot of people were saying to me, if they could describe me in one word, it would be resilient, you know, because I've gone through so many evolutions and I'm very comfortable with change. Mm. In actual fact, I think I get bored when things are not moving. I think absolutely one of the things that happens when you lose people is you kind of go inward, and it is a positive thing and a negative thing, right? Because even in that, I'm having to learn to be outward in some instances. I'm still very much an introverted person, and people would not understand that until they hear me speak about my life, because they see me on stage and I'm confident and I can tell my story and I can speak. That's a gift. It's not necessarily my personality. It's a gift that I'm able to stand on stage and do the work that I do in the way that I do it and be able to be vulnerable and connect with people. That's a gift. But in actual fact, if I was just me and I wasn't put in a position in some way to be doing the work that I'm doing, I'd probably have a private account with like 100 people who are all my friends. And now I have like this massive Instagram community, but that's work. So it really makes you kind of go inward in terms of figuring out how to sustain and solve your own problems. I'm definitely one of those people who has had to learn to accept help, because when all of that happened and everyone went their separate ways, I had to figure out how to live. Like, how do I take care of myself? So I'm very, very big on being accountable for myself. And it's so funny because it goes back to that quote that you read at the beginning, where I find power in knowing that I have autonomy. Anything that's happening in my life, I can control. I am in control of it. And yes, there are many factors and variables around what life throws at us. But whatever life throws at me, I'm never in a position where I'm just like, oh my gosh, if this happened, I would never be able to survive it. I think there's nothing that life can throw at me, and I wouldn't sit back and think, how do I navigate this? How do I make something out of this? How do I live through this and I don't die in it? So I'd never really connected it to the losses, but in a way, I guess, you know, you do go inwards and you start to build a resilience, and it doesn't mean you still don't get hurt by things, and you're still not longing maybe to have that openness that other people have who've always lived their lives and things just worked out. But I've learned to appreciate all the things that I am and to embrace them, and the parts that I would want to change, to kind of also be graceful in the process of figuring out if I can still become something else. But yes, it's really, I can live by myself. I am very comfortable in solitude, and I have built a healthy relationship with solitude. It's probably the place where a lot of my ideas come from. And because also I'm a believer in God, it's also the place where I hear God's voice clearly. And it's a combination of everything that has happened that has led me here that really creates this amazing life, as far as I see it for myself.
Yeah, I think that's probably your secret power. The shaking is the fact that the shaking doesn't shake you. That's like your secret power. You know that no matter what is shaking around you, you end up on solid ground, you know? And so I think that's so incredible. Now, I want to kind of transition into the amazing work that you've done, because I could, you know me, you and me, we can have a heart to heart, honestly. But, you know, I really want to give people the benefit of just really being able to get into the mind of Norm Denny. Like, friend, your mind is insane. Do you understand? Like, do you know, it's like, I often look at what you've done. I'll actually track back to a story. There was a time, because we didn't live far from each other when I was still in South Africa, and you were still at the Ogilvy offices. Your office was operating from out of there. And I remember being there, and you were starting to build this agenda woman. You know, you were going through all the ideas of what agenda woman looked like, what it was. You were like, is it going to be a digital platform? You had all these plans and everything. And honestly, like, I loved spending time with you because you're cool. And we'd always have these deep conversations. And, you know, I was kind of going through a challenging time. And so talking to you was always like nurturing to my heart. But I was always like, you know, you're always like, you would throw everything out there. You threw everything until something stuck, you know? So when a gender woman like became what it was, I was just like, wow. I don't think I've ever been in proximity of somebody who has built something, you know, from an emotion. You literally built a gender woman from a purpose and from an emotion. So, you know, I want to shift into gear of like what it really takes to be able to create what you've created, which is basically like an empire, you know, it is an empire where your primary objective and purpose is to support other women. How do you even go to a brand and say, or how do you even monetize that? How do you even get into a place of commercializing that? Because we all have like nice ideas. I want to heal the world, you know, and this is literally like an emotion. So talk to us about the process of being able to get a gender woman off the ground, the concept of it, and how you've been able to make it what it is. Because I think that that is like probably one of the best marketing cases, case studies and business case studies I've ever seen.
It's so interesting. It's. I think one of the things that I do know that I'm good at is execution, right? But sitting enough in strategy to understand, to kind of see 10 steps ahead, right? So there's people who stay in strategy too long until the ideas swallow them and they feel overwhelmed by the ideas. I have a way of sitting in strategy long enough to know that I'm ready to move. I'm also not afraid to take risks. And I've been burned. Like some things don't work. But somehow I do have a fearlessness in me. I do have a very bold spirit. I have a lot of courage. And it's such a weird thing to explain, because at the same time, I'm just like, it's not fun when things don't work out, but somehow there's been so much grace on my life that even the things that haven't worked out have not been explosive failures, if I can call it that. Somehow they've just been contained, right? It's like, I know that didn't work, but most of the time it's because I had a super idea and people were just like, this is amazing. And I'm like, oh, really? So I always have like the big, big idea. And then whatever I do, and then people are just like, oh my gosh. And I'm just like, this is nothing compared to what I actually want to do, but it's great, you know? So even in my work with building brands like DJ Zinhle and Oskido, it was not something that I understood I could do, but I am very good at knowing what the next step is, what the immediate thing I can do is. And I think a lot of people get stuck with wanting to understand and kind of perfect the next 10 steps. I can sit and think, okay, in 10 steps, I could potentially be there, but also be okay with maybe not, but at least I know where I want to go. And I am definitely sure about what the first step is, and I can do that. So Agenda Woman has been the same thing. I mean, if I just had to summarize some quick moments that can kind of paint a picture of how my mind works when it comes to how I got to Agenda Woman, it's a lot of curiosity also. I'm very, very curious. And, you know, I'm always looking at what's happening around the world. And like, I'm the type of person who will go and find the financials for a company that looks like something I want to build and better understand how they are making money, you know, and not just the things that they are posting, but actually going to, if it's listed, I will find the financials and look through everything and get someone to explain to me what everything is. So I'm extremely curious. So with Agenda Woman, it started off as something where I was like, I just want to talk to 20 girls. And I had no idea it would be Agenda Woman. I was just like, I want to talk to 20 girls. I was going through a big transition in my life. It was very, very hard. And I thought, you know what? Now that I don't have all the might and glory of, oh, it's Nomneni who is, you know, golden girl who can do all kinds of things. I've gone through my first big crash in my coming into my 30s. I was like, okay, well, I'm here. What do I really want to do? You know, and the thing I knew I wanted to do, just if you wake up one day and just like, if I could do something, what would it be? For me, it was just talking to young girls. I had this idea of sitting up a table at Protea, Fire and Ice in Melrose with 20 girls. And like maybe like, you know, I didn't even drink at the time and I was coming into my 30s. So I was just like seeing, you know, maybe tea and whatever. And I put up a post on my social media at the time, and I didn't have really an amazing following, but I had seen momentum because I had done a kind of campaign. You know, sometimes you're just like, oh, for the next 30 days, I want to do this. That's another way that I evolve into things. I challenge myself. And afterwards, I was like, oh my gosh, now I don't have this engagement and conversation. Can I bring that conversation into real life? And I put out a call to action saying, if you want to hang out with me, just email me. At the end of the day, we had 100 emails. And I didn't say, girls must email me. I just said, just email me. We had 100 emails at the end of the day. And then I went into my strategic brain, my execution brain. I said to my team, let's put something together. Everything was for free. Like they got a venue for free. It was so basically compared to how I do things. It was so basic, but I just had this pull. There was something that was pulling me to connect with people, and I followed it. And I think that's another thing. People, we all have an instinct around something that we want to do, but a lot of times we're scared because we're just like, oh, but then what does it become? all I did was have a conversation. I remember Destiny magazine was part of it at the time. And then I did a couple, but I was really going through a tough time, Lee. The following year, that was 2016, 2017, I didn't do anything. And then my team was like, maybe let's do something in August. You see, I never chose August. My team said to me, maybe let's do something in August, because everyone that kept coming to my things was a woman. And I did something in August with Standard Bank, nothing fancy. They just gave me a venue and they paid for the food and maybe there were like 50 people. But I enjoyed it so much. I enjoyed speaking to people about their stories so much. And that was 2017. At the end of 2017, I was still also trying to figure out, what do I want to do next? Because I knew I didn't want to do what I was doing anymore, but I didn't know what it is that I wanted to do. But I knew that I liked this conversation thing that I kept doing. Can't even tell you how I was sustaining myself, which is another story for another day. Then I went and I saw a coach, because I was like, maybe if I speak to a coach, they'll help me figure out how to just package my thoughts. And this guy, I think I sit with him for like an hour and a half. At the end, he says to me, why aren't you doing something around women? And I'm like, no, that's too niche. I'm trying to build a business here. Like, who cares about building business around women? That's not what I want to do. That's a thing that I do on the side. It's not a business. And he said to me, there is definitely a business there. You need to figure it out. And I was like, you're not helping me. And then I went back home and I thought about it. And I thought, maybe let me turn this thing that I'm doing into something with women. You know, I don't know how it's going to be a business. And then I did that. And then in 2018, I did like back-to-back events every month, because I was like, oh, let me try and do that, you know. And I lost a lot of money and I incurred a lot of debt, you know, because it was just like, it was so overwhelming to plan a new event every month at a different venue. So the insight I came up with, I came out of 2018 with, is you can't do different venues, but you like the conversations and people are coming. It's not profitable, but people are coming, you know, it's giving you movement and activity. And that's another thing that people don't understand, the power of acting, the power of just moving around your ideas, in and around your ideas, and how the universe finds space to move with you. But when you're standing still, there's nothing that we can do. There's nothing. I feel like the universe is just like, what, like, I don't know how to kind of get the things in front of you, because I can't bring them to your house. Like, even when I bring them, you don't see them because you're not in constant flow with nature, and nature is in constant flow.
Yeah.
So this movement around the things that I liked, even when I was making losses and it wasn't a business and I don't know what it was. And then suddenly I came across a platform that, because I'm doing this thing, and I'm like, how else can I do it better? I was looking at the Forbes Women Summit in New York and what that is, things I'd not been exposed to before, but I was trying to figure out how to make this thing better. Came across a platform that was doing what I thought, oh, this looks pretty and this is what I would love to do. I bought a ticket. I don't know how. I bought a ticket to New York and I attended one of their events. I came back and I was like, oh my gosh, I could never do that. Like, what is that? And I then came back and I was still paralyzed by how massive it was. Like, it was just too overwhelming. And then my friend Mushambi says to me, I challenge you to, I dare you to do something. The one thing you must never do with me, Lee, is challenge me to do anything. Because now I'm just like, I'm going to do it. And I did my first event in 2019. And I took the insight from 2018 around not moving around. I found a home and somehow it settled. You know, when you get that feeling of, this feels easy. This feels better. I'm still connecting with people. It's intimate. I would only do 20 people. It was not profitable, but it felt good. 2020 was the best thing that ever happened, because from my research, I knew that this was a digital platform, but I knew that in South Africa, it was going to take long for that to take off, right? I thought 5 years time, we might look like that thing I saw in New York. When COVID hit, that's where the universe meets you when you're moving, right? It's the opportunity meeting preparedness. And we shared so much digital content in that year that our community grew. Brands were stuck. They didn't know what to do, how to engage communities. They came to us. We were active. We were moving. It was the year I was the most tired. I did a summit in 2020 online, 5,000 signups. The community grew. Amazing. I reached out to my celebrity friends. I started thinking about this working smart and living well. At the same time, I had forced one of my mentors to sit down with me and challenge me to figure out what this thing is. Everything just came together in 2020. And I think that was the year that really defined this thing as a potential business. Also, the first year that I registered as a business, because Standard Bank came and they wanted to advertise on the website that I had challenged myself to create. It was not
the whole time the business was not registered. So you were basically just running this great idea, and it wasn't a business. So anytime somebody could come and snatch it.
It was not a business.
That's crazy.
It was not registered as a business. I was just doing events and I liked connecting with women. So 2020, I created the website on, I launched it on my birthday on the 7th of July. I just found a couple of tutorials online, put all of them together, wrote down things, figured out how to create a website on Squarespace. Everyone was like, oh my gosh, can you make mine? I was like, I don't create websites, because that's another thing. You need to focus. And it's such a difficult thing because you're just like, okay, but what were you focusing on? But I knew the things that I didn't need to be doing at that time, because also I was exhausted. And then Standard Bank reaches out and they're like, oh, we want to advertise top woman on your website. It's an event that they did, which was much bigger. And I was like, okay, I need to register this thing as a business. I don't think they even ended up paying me because I took so long to figure out how to put a banner on the website until they came back and they were like, nah.
Because you're like on your own there.
I'm on my own trying to figure out how to code and all kinds of things. Who can I call? I was so stressed, Lee. But that's what moved me to register this thing as a business. And in 2021, you know, the community was there. I could see this thing is coming together. Mm. And we got our first sponsor, like partnerships in 2021. And I mean cash investments. Because before it was like they're giving me a venue or something. Cash investment from Verve Clicquot, Sanlam and Dove in 2021. But also I had started doing like the influencer thing so that I could get some revenue. And through that, I was building relationships with brands. And because I studied marketing and I used to manage talent, I knew how to kind of create that full circle experience for brands. And I went back to them and I was like, I'm doing this thing. Do you guys want to get involved? And they did. And I could tell you how we got to where we are, but I think you start to see a pattern in terms of how I move and how I make decisions. I never know the full picture. I have a big vision and a big dream, but I just do the next best thing, the thing that I know I can execute right now. And I challenge myself to go a little further every time I move forward.
That's incredible. And the community, the gender woman community, how big would you say, how big is it now? If just to give people an idea.
I'm trying to think. I think we're sitting at probably 250,000 women that we reach through our different platforms, which is absolutely incredible because we haven't even touch the rest of the world in terms of really being intentional about engaging them. This is just mainly people in South Africa and other regions, but a high concentration, of course, in South Africa.
What I really love about it is that the growth for Agenda Woman and the growth for the work that you've been doing has literally been organic. You know, there's nothing that sticks out in a world like we are in now where everything is so over, you know, if we're overexposed, there's so many things flashing at us. But whenever I look at the work that you've done with Agenda Woman, it's been so organic. It's been almost like you've been breathing through every step. Every post feels like you've breathed through it. I don't know how to explain it. It's like there's a pause moment, then you're going to post. There's a, you know, like you have this thing where you just are like, you know, you just like kind of back away. It's like, let me just think before you do anything. And I think that that's so powerful. It's such a powerful thing, even for me, you know, like something that I feel that I can learn from you, because sometimes there's so much noise around you and you just want to quickly do something, and it's okay to breathe and to just stay what you stick the course. You know, I think that that's so powerful. You mentioned certain, I mean, you were, there were so many things that you said that I could unpack, but one of the things that you had mentioned was the work that you, you know, working with Oskido and Galawa Jasmine and DJ Zinclair. So for people who don't know, you actually were, I think you and Zinclair were the first people to register a DJ school for women, which is insane. You know, that's amazing. I remember when that was happening, I was just like, wow, this is incredible. You know, especially at that point where you didn't have women in the forefront of being DJs, you know? So I thought that that was incredible. But it in the time that you were doing that, you also were the person who could influence one of the most powerful people, if not the most powerful person in South African music, who's Oskido, who is basically behind what we see happening in South African music right now. So when you think of where Amapiano is now, it goes back to the days of Oskido. Like, he is like the guy. You're like this young thing. You show up. How does it happen that you end up working with Oskido? And on top of that, you had the courage and you had the solutions and the answers. Talk to us about that. I think also from the perspective of not being afraid to share your voice as a woman when you enter a room, even when they're people who perhaps are more, you know, people who've been in the game for a longer time than you. Just, you know, paint a picture of that and the things that you learned and some of the cute stories, because I think that there's so much that can be learned from that.
It's such a funny story. Like, and I've told it a couple of times, but you must remember, I grew up in a small town in Newcastle. I was a church girl, so I didn't really understand the might of mosquito, you know? And that worked for me because I did when I first met him, I didn't have the oh, it's a mosquito. I met someone, and in actual fact, I just met someone whose radio show we could use to market our school, right? And that was it for me because I was so much in my business brain versus, the culture. I was never a person who understood the culture, and that worked for me. And I think it's such an important lesson to a lot of people that in order to excel in spaces, sometimes you don't need to look like everyone in those spaces. You don't need to fit in. The fact that you're different is the thing that makes people turn and look at you. Because when you go into spaces and you look like everyone who's in those spaces, you're likely going to just blend in. Because I was not a person who was about the culture and moving the culture and wanting to be popular, there was a way that people were like, oh, what's happening here? It almost brings such a refreshing perspective. But of course, you have to deliver value at the end of the day. So when we did the school with Zinhle in 2009, we were so excited. We were so happy. I had come out of like corporate. I'd worked for 2 seconds at corporate and I knew it wasn't for me. So the school was actually a way for me to leave my job because I was like, oh, let me try this thing. I didn't think I was an entrepreneur. I just knew that I don't want to work for a corporate. It just didn't make sense to me. Why am I so far from the CEO? Are we not building a business? I didn't realize that I was a small part of building the business. I thought, I'm gonna know everything. Like, I wanna know, like, what's Discovery doing next and how do we strategize and all of that. Because I also didn't have a lot of like career mentoring. So I really was one of those kids who just, all I knew is that I need to find a job. I didn't have like an a glamorous career plan around, oh, this is what I wanna do. And I never felt like I could actually build a career in corporate. I just felt like I didn't feel like how I
You couldn't
feel
go.
about entrepreneurship, where I have confidence and I know I can be an entrepreneur. In at work, I didn't feel like that. I felt like I was the girl at the back. I've always been able to communicate well, but I didn't feel confident in the workplace. So I exited that very quickly and I was lucky. And that also speaks to courage because I didn't know what I was doing. Zinta came to me and I was like, I've been thinking about doing a DJ in school. And I was like, yes, that's what we're doing. And I went and I found a house and I found a company that was going to give us a license with a curriculum because I was just like, that's what we're doing. And it felt good for me to figure those things out and come up with solutions around structuring and building a business versus going to work in corporate. I felt empowered as an entrepreneur. So when we're doing that, of course, we don't know what we're doing. So we're not making money, but everyone is talking about this thing. We were also surprised by how people took it up. It was never a thing that we thought would end up like that. But then when I started to see how people were getting excited about it, I thought this would be a great way for us to position Zintle's brand as a leader in the space. Because there were many other female DJs at the time. But for me, it was like, if we position you as someone who empowers other female DJs, you definitely move forward. You become number one in the space. You don't become another struggling DJ who's trying to make it to the top for themselves. You become a leader when you support other people. That's the power of leadership. And so we kind of kept that going, but we were not making money, but we were so happy. We used to listen to vinyls and old school house at the end of the day. The girls coming in, seeing the impact we were making there. Like, that's what was fulfilling for me. But Zinhle was like, bro, we're not making money and we need to figure out how to make money. I'm DJing, but you're gonna get left behind, because financially you are focusing on this thing. So I think you should help Mosquito because I can see like what how I've seen you do this thing. I think that's what he needs for Kalawa. There's no structure. We don't know what we're doing. We don't have contract. Like, we need something to work at Kalawa. And I was like, okay, But I was just like, I'm happy here. And then there was a day or a month where I was just like, okay, I need money, So I woke up one day, I had met him a couple of times, but I was also very intentional about how I showed up when I was around talent. I was very, very intentional about showing up differently and not looking like I want to be like them, but being very clear that I'm different, but I'm smart and I know what I'm doing. So every time we would go to IFM for the interviews on Saturday on the Feminine Touch, I think that was the name of the slot that Sinclair had on a Skittles show. I mean, I was in heels, Lee, every day. I was in heels. I liked heels anyway, but it kind of worked for me,
Some of
right?
us were in
I was
sneakers every day.
You guys were in sneakers, you had like purple hairstyles and mohawks and all kinds of things. I was in heels going into YFM every day for interviews. I remember thinking, who do I want to emulate? And at the time, I was like, I'm going to dress up like Michelle Obama. Imagine looking like Michelle Obama at YFM. And I was just like, that's my wardrobe. That's how I'm going to show up. Because what you need to understand about branding and personal branding is that it's perception. You can build a particular perception around how people receive you. And for me, that was all it was. It was like, I want to be perceived as a serious business person, so I'm going to show up like a serious business person. And it worked. Because by the time I woke up one day and I sent an SMS to Oskido saying, make me your PA. And he said, why? And I said, because I need the money and you need the help. He could take me seriously. He had seen me respond to questions around the business. He had seen me carrying my laptop all the time. It was a joke, but it meant that they are seeing that I'm carrying my laptop all the time. He had seen me in heels. He was taking me seriously. So when I sent that message to him, there was a place for it to land because the soil was already cultivated. And that was the beginning of our conversation. We go to Durban. We're doing South African Music Conference. We were speaking there because we were like, now the female representation in entertainment. And I remember he says to me, let's go for a drive. And I mean, I still don't know the might of this guy because we're also building. I just feel like everyone is trying to figure things out. But I mean, everyone knew what he had done already. And we're driving around Durban and he says to me, so what are you saying? You know how men are and how boys are. I've said already what I've said. Like, you should be giving me an answer. He's like, so what are you saying? I'm like, no, I feel like I can help you. You know, this is what I've done with Fuse and we can just try it out. And he says to me, okay, yeah, but I don't have money. I'll pay you 3,000 rands.
You're like...
I'm like, sir, I know how much you charge an hour. You're a DJ. Like, anyway, I say yes. I say, okay, no problem. Let's go.
Yeah.
You know? And he says, okay. And I feel like he was testing me. I still need him to explain to me why he offered me 3,000 rands. But anyway, I say, okay, no problem. So we come back to Joburg. He asked me to come to his house. He had an office at his house and it was a mess, Lee. Like, there were papers everywhere. There was no office, basically. And luckily, I'm a very structured thinker. So I'm just like, okay, this man doesn't even know what he wants me to do. And I always say this to young people now who come into environments expecting that someone is going to tell you everything. If that's your opportunity, you need to make it work. He didn't know what I could do or what he should tell me to do. So he just brought me to his office. He took a piece of paper. He explained the different businesses that he had. And he was like, okay, this one, I'm not going to need you to get involved, but these ones are the ones that you can help me with. And I was like, okay. And then he didn't know, like, okay, then now what? Like, what do we do? So I said to him, okay, listen, I can see that there's a lot of paperwork. Just go and buy me files. And I looked through each and every piece of paper to kind of get a clue which one belongs to which business. And I put together those files. And by the time he left me there and then he came back and he found that, like, his office was neat and everything was tidy. And he was like, okay, maybe you can do this with my emails as well. So he gave me access to his emails and I started reading through all the things that people were emailing him about that he hadn't responded. I remember I found an email from Network BBDO, which was an agency, and they wanted him to be part of a campaign. I was able to negotiate like 300,000 for him to be part of that campaign. He brought along the other Kalawa guys and he said to me, okay, I'll give you 10% of everything you bring in. And he never paid me 3,000 rands. Like, the first amount of money he paid me was 30,000 rands.
Yeah, that's so powerful. Because it even just like, it feels as though you knew where you wanted to go at some point. So you're like, you're just willing to get in. It's like that whole thing of just getting in the room and adding value, you know?
And I think this is what's important for people to understand. You need to know who you want to be. Forget what you want to be, who you want to be. Do you want to be taken seriously? What does that look like? It means you show up. Every single time you have an engagement with someone, I always say it's a touch point. You know, when you experience a brand and you're like, I found a Coca-Cola that the C was not written. That's a touch point. That's a brand experience. That's how people are experiencing you. You might not know what you want to be, but every single time you show up, be very clear about how you want to be perceived. And all I did, Lee, because I didn't know what it would lead to me working with Oskido, I just needed money because I wanted to stay at Fuse. That part I wanted. I wanted to stay at Fuse. I wanted to be taken seriously and I wanted to be excellent at whatever it is that I touched. So when I showed up at his business, I carried that same value. It didn't matter that the business was owned by him. It didn't matter that he made more money than me. It didn't matter that probably I was doing so much more work. I understood my position and I understood why I was there. I wasn't expecting him to create this dream for me, which I see with a lot of young people now. They come into environments and they expect you to do more than them. I knew that I want to be excellent in everything I do. So anything I touch, if I'm going to be sweeping, I want to do it excellently. If I'm going to be doing organizing your files, I want it to be excellent. If I'm going to be reading through your emails, I want to honor you as a person who's opening a door for me, who doesn't know what to do with me. But the fact that you've opened the door, I'm going to show up. I'm going to come on time every day. I'm going to ask you what more I can do to help you. I'm not going to look at my job description and say, oh, this is all that I'm doing, because I know why I am there. And once I've gotten that, then I'll move on to the next thing. But I understood that I did not want to go to corporate. I wanted to stay at Fuse, and this man is willing to pay me. So I'm going to make sure that that paycheck stays and it remains. And luckily, I made so much money working with Oskiro because he was God sent. I often look around the industry and I'm just like, actually, no one is going to do this for me, to be honest. No shade on anyone. But Oskiro is the most generous person I know, the most kind-hearted person I know, the most authentic person I know. He was the guy who was going to say, Nomdeni, everything I make, I'll give you 10%. And I made so much money because I knew that everything I was doing, I was going to be compensated. And even in moments when he couldn't, it was not a train smash for me because I already trusted his heart. And I knew that if he's not giving me money, it means there's something else that's going on in his life, or there's something he needs to take care of, or we need to move it into something else. There was just a trust which still exists to this day. I always say, anytime Oskiro calls me, I move. I think I could be the president of the world. If I get a call from Oskiro, I will move because of how much he honored me as an individual and how much he showed up for me in the industry as well, in just protecting me. I was a woman working around men. And I only found out later that he actually went around to all of the guys who were, you know, high up, and he said to them, whatever you do, do not mess with this girl. I am going to make money with this girl. I don't want drama around her. And that's why everyone stayed away from me.
That's so powerful. I mean, it's really just so powerful when people are literally God sent into your life, you know, and all of that. And I just, and I also think that it's so great that you're so determined to just keep honoring him, because that's another lesson that we can learn, you know, even when you get to like, you're like miles down the road, never forget the people who got you started and people who believed when nobody else did, you know. I remember that you moderated a conversation for HBO in New York or something, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
A while back. You moderated a conversation for HBO, but while you were about to get on stage, and you know, and it was quite a full room, you got really not great news from South Africa. So, I wanted to, with regards to your business. So let's talk about this, because I think sometimes with businesses, especially when you're entrepreneurs, everything is, it's very hard to not say it's emotional, but man, it's emotional.
I had built such a good reputation with the work that I did with Oskiro and the artists around him, because after I started working with him, and I think he saw the potential of what I could create and build with him, he opened up the entire Rolodex. So I worked with Black Motion. I met everyone through Oskiro, and I did some kind of work with them or in building their brands. And through that work and the eventing that we did with him, like all the things that we did, I met not only the artists in South Africa, I also was exposed to corporate South Africa, because it's Oskiro. When you go to a meeting with Oskiro, you're not meeting the brand manager, you're meeting the marketing director, you know? So you get to really get insight into what the marketing world looks like and how they collaborate with talent and how they build brands and how they speak to consumers. And it was also just such a divine intervention, because I studied marketing. So I'm finding myself in rooms with marketing personnel, but it's not like I don't have to kind of climb the corporate ladder. It's almost like, now I'm speaking to the CEO and the CMO, or I'm speaking to the CMO and the marketing director, and I'm getting really key insights around how they develop strategies and how they think about branding. And through that, because Oskiro had given me so much power and autonomy, I was the person who I could walk into the room with him, have the meeting. But once we're done with the first meeting, then I'm taking over the entire relationship. And now that exposes me to marketing in South Africa, but also exposes the marketers to me and how I work and who I am. And through that work, I then get approached by Unilever to come and present my business credentials. I didn't even know what that meant. You know, I just worked with Oskido and I solved the problems that we had with Oskido. But they invite me to present my business credentials because they're looking for a Black-owned agency that can be part of their procurement at Unilever. Imagine, like, I still cannot. I remember, like, going through that whole process and thinking, what the hell is going on? I had to call someone and say, what do they mean when they say I should present my business credentials? Like, my main client is Oskido and all the talent. Like, what business credentials, you know? And someone,
like, those are my credentials.
You know what I'm saying? Like, how does that fit into what they want from me? You know, I then put together the deck. I go and I present, and it's like, I think 6 people in the room, and I am scared. I think I slept at 3 a.m. that morning, and I prayed and I walked in and I said, this is who I am. This is what I do. I found, like, smart words, you know, to kind of package everything. And I walked away. And I think a couple of days later, they called me and they said, you got the account, you know, you are going to be one of our communications or PR agencies, that's what you call it today, for Unilever. And I remember the first brief they sent me was for Dawn. And then they kind of dropped that. And then they sent me a brief for Lux. And I remember this was 2015 when influencer marketing was nothing, because Unilever has always been just ahead of the game when it comes to marketing disciplines. I remember I was booking influencers who today are big. I remember I booked Mihlali at one of the campaigns that I did that year. She was 19 and she came with her mom and she was just like, my mom, I don't know why she's here. It was insane, like, the work that I was doing at the time and how, when I see how it's grown now, it's just incredible. But yes, then I became the marketing partner for Unilever. But Lee, I had no idea how to run an agency. I had no idea what I was doing. I knew how to work with Oskido. I did not know how to run an agency. I did not know how to cost appropriately. I did not know what was an honorable markup. And because also I'm a person who's grounded in integrity, I was just like, what is acceptable? You know, when you do markups, how do I bill for the people that are doing the work? Because a lot of the time also I was so used to working autonomously around creating ideas and making the move. I was not ready to build that business, but I could turn out the creative work. I could execute, but my financials and running the financial part of my business, I was not ready for that. So I remember in trying to figure all of that out, I had onboarded someone who I thought was experienced and would be able to help me figure that out. And there were so many people I hired who I paid who really brought so much strain on the business versus making the business better. I was just not equipped to figure out how to run the business. I could deliver to the client, but I was not running a proper business. And in New York, I'm moderating a conversation on the Africa creative economy. The CEO of HBO is in the building. Russell Simmons is in the building. And I'm having this moment, this high moment, and I get a call that one of the people that I had worked with had gone to the client and said, you know, they were not happy with the way that we had worked with them and they had not come to me. And honestly, that was the beginning, I think, of me reckoning with the fact that I really was not in a position where I knew how to run my business. That was a reckoning with the betrayal from that person, because in essence, the reason they did that is because they wanted to take over their account. And this was someone senior and much more experienced than me. Luckily, I had a very solid relationship with Unilever, and kudos to them, because they were on a mission to empower me, right? But at the time when all of that was happening, there was a lot of breakdown, even in my personal life. It was just a moment where everything just crashed. And looking back now, I know why it happened. But when it happened, I was just like, what in the world is happening? I end up getting stuck in New York because I don't have access to money to change my tickets around. I was meant to be in New York for a long time, but now I'm paying out so many things because I'm trying to fix, you know, the everything, the reputation and everything that's going on. And I end up stuck in New York. I remember I was staying at a friend's apartment in Bed-Stuy, and it was an apartment that didn't have furniture. Literally all that was there was a mattress, and I needed to figure out how to have food for about 6 weeks until I came home. But I think there was a way that God was secluding me, and he needed to keep me there. He needed to keep me in that place. And that's when my true friendships emerged. That is when I took the time to think about who am I and what do I want to do? Like, it was very hardly, but there was a lot of silence and I needed silence. I was definitely living a very egotistical life, although I was not prideful. I don't know how to explain it. You know, when everywhere you go, everyone is talking about how amazing you are. You don't realize how much that thing gets into your head if you're not intentionally creating moments of
clicking out.
Like, we're always immersed in some kind of experiment and experience and energy. And I didn't realize how much I'd been living to now uphold that reputation, but I was not living to really be purposeful and be grounded in who am I and what am I here to do. So that was a tough time that brought along a lot of change. A lot of things fell to the ground and they were never picked up, because in a way, God had said, was saying, I've taught you everything that I need to teach you to go to the next phase. So everything I'd done was necessary for the next phase, but there were things that needed to stay behind and everything had to be taken away. And when I came back, it was, you know, if I thought New York was bad, it became worse. You know, I come back to this dilemma and I'm so much in my head about my inability to do the running of my business that I don't realize that actually my client is still supporting me. So I'm not showing up fully for my client. And then Unilever goes through this massive change where the global Unilever is wanting to get the global businesses to kind of come into the region and service their clients. So I lose Unilever. But what I'd also done as a mistake is when I moved into Unilever to figure out how to service that client, I had let go of all my talent, who were a big revenue stream for the business. So probably 95% of my revenue was coming from one client, which was a huge business mistake, but I did not know that it was a huge mistake. So when I lost the client, 95% of my business was gone. And the shame of losing that client, of the how I lost the client, engulfed me. I couldn't think. I just thought, what do I do now?
There's a psychology behind money that we perhaps don't understand, but I know that it's something that you've been able to understand from the extreme highs to the extreme, like, below low lows, you know. Just talk about the relationship with money. And even as an entrepreneur, because this is a lesson that I've had to learn so hard about not having one source of revenue. You know, if you rely on one client, your business is not functioning. So let's go into everything that you have, the things that you have learned about money, personal, running a business, and also, you know, doing good work and doing purpose-driven work, and what you learned and what you think people need to learn in those different instances.
I'll try and share whatever comes up, because I think there's so much that I've learned about money, particularly our relationship with money. And I continue to learn, actually. It's such a nuanced conversation, as it relates, I think, mostly, and I'm going to speak to my personal experience, people of color and our relationship to money, because we come from a place where we were surviving a lot. It's so funny because this year, I don't have a word for 2024. I almost have a mantra. I don't even know if it's a mantra, but I said to my friend, this year, everything I do is going to be about moving from surviving to thriving. I need to know what it looks like to thrive. And I think a lot of people don't know what it looks like to thrive. They think it's your ability maybe to buy a Louis Vuitton bag, and nothing against luxury items. But I think a lot of what people think thriving with is about, it's very closely intertwined with how we link our worth to what we have. And then you think you're thriving. Right? If I am buying specific things and therefore perceived a particular way, then I'm thriving. A lot of the money that I made, Lee, it was such a silly thing. And people do this even to this day. I hear people talking and I'm just like, you're doing this thing that doesn't work, where you're like, oh, okay, that job, you know, even when I was booking talent, if you're booking out Black Motion, you're booking out Zintle, you're booking out Oskido, you're booking out Heavy K at that time, you're booking out Professor, you're making a lot of money in one weekend. Even if you're making 10% of that, it's a lot of money in one weekend. So I would be like the kind of person who would sit and think, okay, there's these bookings coming in next week. There I'm going to make maybe 250K. I mean, this 300K I have now probably could buy two bags. I'm going to make it next week. I'm going to get it back for 70K because I like it. I like it. And I, in actual fact, I like how it feels to live in a particular way. But I don't understand that when you're making money, you need to kind of, you know how the Bible says, it's so funny because I'm reading the Bible again and there's this chapter, and I know we all know it from Sunday school, where Joseph tells Pharaoh about, explains the dream that he has about the famine that's coming for 7 years and how they're going to have a good year, 7 years of abundance, and there's a good, there's a 7 years that's coming. Life works that way. You're going to go through winters and summers. Mm-hmm. And I think when we're in our summer, we forget to prepare for our winter. It's the rainy day that we all saw in 2020, mm-hmm. right? When people were getting retrenched from their jobs, and understanding how to create rules around how you live and what your money can do for you versus how you use your money as a tool to feel worthy to be seen. A lot of it stems from how we feel about ourselves and using money as a tool to kind of say, I'm not as bad as what you guys think I am. And most of the time, people are not even thinking about you, honestly. It's how you feel about yourself that makes you behave a particular way as it pertains to money, which is the starting point. So even when I lost the Unilever account, Lee, if I had a healthy relationship with how I saw myself and money, I was not going to feel shame. I was going to go back to my client and say, how do we unpack this? How can we do things better? Mm-hmm. I was going to be in my mind and not in my heart about what was happening. But because everything was around, oh, I have this big client. Oh, I have, this is who I am. I do things great. And it, my money was, and my work were the way that I defined who I was and that I was worthy to be alive. Because I was not grounded in purpose. I was not really offering impactful work that was sustaining and fulfilling me. The thing that was fulfilling me was the perception that people had of what I was able to do. And it was closely linked to money. So when you take that away, then who am I? And I had not answered that question. Who are you when everything is taken away? And that's always the starting point, I find, Lee. So one of the things that I did in my journey of just figuring out what is money in my life? Where does it sit in my life? You have to first think about also what is your life? Because money is one part. It's not all of your life. I did a course on healing my relationship with money. I realized that there was a lot of pain associated with money, and I was using money to mask the pain. One of the things that happened for me when I was growing up is my parents did lose, my grandparents did lose some of their businesses. So I always had this anxiety around money, that money is going to go. It's not, I didn't have a healthy relationship around money and, you know, settling into this money, it's enough, right? So even in how I used it, I was rushing because what if it's not there? But it was happening subconsciously. So the beginning is unpacking, what are your beliefs around money? What comes up when you think about money? Because if you are not clear about that, it filters through into your decisions around your business. Because Lee, I can tell you right now, when I advise people about business and money, you still need to action that. And you won't believe my advice if it's not aligned with your values, your intrinsic values around what you understand money to be. So even if I said to you, you need to have, without fail, you need to have 20%, like you need to save 20%, or you need to have investments, or you need to have a healthy relationship with debt. Because even our unhealthy relationship with debt is based off anxiety. And where does that anxiety comes from? Mm-hmm. It's the feeling that it's not enough and it's going to go away. So I can give you all the advice in the world. If the ground that we're speaking on is not cultivated and fertile for you to understand what I'm saying to you, you're still going to be very emotional about your money decisions. So I had to start there, because I promise you, a lot of the breakdown of my things have also come from how I was feeling around my worth and how I needed to show up and how I wasn't paying attention to that. That's the first thing. And that's the personal one before we get even into the business rules and how you need to think about things when you're a business. Of course, when you're running a business, you need to have multiple revenues. I think 2020 showed everyone that, right? So when I think about my business, for instance, I have the services that we offer as a business. Right. So there's the services part of the business, which speaks to a lot of B2B. Right. So it's money, making money from other businesses. And then I have my speaking engagements, which speak to me as a personal brand and sharing my knowledge, which also is a different reasoning and marketing channel and revenue channel as well. And then we also have the B2C aspect where we are selling to our consumer. And before we did the store, our B2C was mainly tickets, but I knew I needed to figure out another B2C funnel that would allow us to have a direct relationship with consumers that allowed our businesses to survive, because the B2B, it's huge chunks of money, but when it leaves because brands are pivoting. They are deciding to do something else. And that's their strategy. You know, you're not part of their strategy to infinity or in perpetuity. So you need to, whilst your heart, think about what does it look like? You know, yesterday I was speaking to someone about another revenue stream that we're building into the business. And he said to me, your projections are too optimistic. They're good, but they're too optimistic. You need to work on your worst case scenario and figure out what your business looks like on the worst case scenario. And then when you get into the projections that are the best case scenario, then you're winning, but you're also ready for the worst case scenario. So we also just don't do a lot of planning when it comes to finances. One of the things I do without fail every year at the beginning of the year is project. What can my financial revenue look like this year? And where is it going to come from? And then I start to build from there. And then when I start to make decisions around what is going to bring in money, that's when I start to ask myself the purpose question. Is it in line with how we want to exist as a business? Is this something that solves the problem that we're saying the business solves? Because also I'm not running a general dealer, so I just can't come up with everything and anything. Somehow these things need to be in harmony and it needs to be a choir. And that really was the birth of AW Brand & Co., which was the pop-up shop that we launched in December. It was about addressing a revenue funnel that we own as a business, but it was also about figuring out how do we create that revenue funnel in a way that we still solve for the purpose and impact in a purposeful and impactful way for our community. I fundamentally believe that the community that we service can give us revenue. I know that. The question was always, how do you demonstrate value so that people can give you money for the value that you give them? And that's a big solve that a lot of businesses don't really interrogate. And I see a lot of women build from, oh, I like doing this, which is fine. But you also need to give yourself a timeline around when do you then pivot into commercializing the thing that you like, if that's what you want to do. It's also okay to have a hobby. It's also okay to be fully employed. But if you are really wanting to build a business around your hobby, you are going to need to ask yourself the hard questions around what is the value that I'm bringing to which consumer? And that's always the starting point. If you can define that, that's always a good place, because when you speak to people, then they'll start to give you clues around what their needs are, because you've suddenly shown them also what their pain points are. Because when you communicate with consumers, you need to tell them that's the fundamental of building businesses, is addressing a pain point and figuring out how do you solve a problem for people in a way that is economically viable for you.
You've always been a visionary. Like the minute like something is going great in your life, you're on to the next one while everybody's celebrating this one thing. So just, you know, just let us, how does that, you know, how do you open a store at the Mall of Africa, which I think is the biggest mall, I think, in South Africa or in Africa, if I'm not mistaken, in an economic hard time when everybody's moving to digital spaces? You already, the brand is doing extremely well digitally. So what is AW Brand & Co.? How does this even happen?
It's so crazy. That even for me was just like, because I, like I said, it's like, for me, it's like, it's small, different pieces. It's never like, oh, it's this big pie. It's just like, okay, this is the bites that I can take now, chew that, bite and chew that. I thought about this thing when I was reading the Verve Clicquot Barometer findings. So they have a report that they share every year on the state of female entrepreneurship in around the world. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, you know, entrepreneurs are struggling with the same things. It's particularly female founders, because it's focused on female founders. I cannot tell you, Lee, what was happening when I thought, you know, I would love to have a store that houses female founders, but I want to have it over the Christmas season, because also I'm a marketer, right? So I always think solution, story, like how do we get consumers excited? My mind works like that automatically. I'm like, okay, I'd love to have a store. I want to have it in the mall because I want to, the narrative is I'm giving female founders foot traffic, mall foot traffic during festive season. So all of them are online, but there's an opportunity for them to be in a mall and take advantage of the foot traffic. And if I bring a partner on board, they are helping these female founders do that, right? And then I go to Sensen City. This was 2022. Sensen City had emailed me about wanting to do something with me. And I'm like, maybe I can do it here. They show me the space. And I'm like, this is not it. I'm very big on energy and experience. I said, this is not it. But also, I understand consumer journey. I understand who our consumer is. I understand what will be appealing for them. I understand what will also drive social media traffic. And I was like, this doesn't do that. This won't do that. And then I went away and I didn't think about it. And then in 2023, when I was thinking about what I want to do, I said, I want to do this thing in December. And I thought about it a little bit. After the summit, I said, okay, one last thing before the end of the year. And then I'm like, that shop that I wanted to do, maybe let me do that. And I start calling people like, okay, do you think I should do Sensen Menlyn or Mall of Africa? Let's talk about what the people that are in the different malls. And I'm like, Menlyn is far, and I know who's in Menlyn. Sensen, yes, it does have a bit of elevation, but this they won't give me the space that I want. If I'm in Sensen, I want to be where Zara is and all of those shops, and they won't give me that. I don't even think the space there. And then I call Mall of Africa, and it just so happens that they have an opening for a space that is next door Versace and Gap, opposite Michael Kors, in their premium precinct. And they were still fitting that shop with like lighting and everything. Divine intervention, which always for me is there. And a friend of mine says, okay, we used to do something with Mall of Africa. I'll give you their number. And the person who used to be there is not there anymore. But there's this other amazing, amazing lady who is obsessed with female founders. Divine intervention. It's moving. It's the power of moving. Because there's so many people who are ready to help you if you just move. I go there and I have a meeting with her and I say to her, Yasmin, I'm scared. I don't know if this will work. I don't know if it's worth the investment, which, by the way, I bootstrap this business. I've not had investments. Someone came to me and said, what does your investment portfolio look like when they came to the shop? And I was like, there's no investors. I've bootstrapped this business. I make money. I take profits. I invest back into the business. And even the shop, I invested, like the business invested in itself to build that shop. I did though. Here's another point that's quite important. During the summit, 2022, we created something amazing. Everyone started doing something similar. Then I said, 2023, what are we going to do differently? I remember I had a marketplace in 2022 and I hated it because it gave me very marketplace, and I'm not a marketplace girl. I like beautiful things. So I said, how do I still do this but elevate it? Then I said, I'm going to create a pop-up experience. So everyone is going to come into one place. It won't be tables. It's going to be designed like a shop, but it's going to be a stand at the Agenda Women Summit. So that's when I did the investment on all the fittings that you saw at the shop in December. I took the money from the partners at the summit and I created that. And then I moved that to the shop in December. So it was something I'd already spent money on, but I was still scared. And I spoke to so many people. I'm like, I'm so scared. And everyone was like, no, do it. And I was like, yeah, you guys are going to benefit from me doing it. So of course you want me to do it. And then one day I was sitting with a friend, an acquaintance. And I was telling her, oh, this is what I want to do. And she said to me, Namneni, please do it. And I'm going to tell you from a selfish point of view, I've been trying to get into a particular store for them to stock my products, and they have been declining me. And I can tell you for free, it's because I'm a Black girl. All the reasons that they're giving me, I walk around the shop and I see products that look exactly like what I want to bring. We need a space as Black women where we can demonstrate to the markets that we are able to sell and people like our products. And that was it for me, Lee. That day I came home and I paid for the rents for that space. And from there, panicking, high anxiety, prayer, I pushed through and we made that experience happen. I had a list of brands that I wanted to bring. I knew what kind of experience I wanted to curate. I'm very good at that. I know how to, I like pretty things. So I always want to create beautiful experiences. Then there was a delay because I wanted, one of the things I always do, I never do business without a contract. Then my lawyer took very long to put together the contract, but I also needed to understand what needed to be in the contract because I needed to tell him that. So that was the part that took long, but I knew non-negotiable. I was not going to move without people signing contracts. And everyone who had been excited when I shared the idea with them, once they saw the contract, they were like, oh, maybe not. Oh, maybe. I remember feeling like, oh my gosh, what if I go into this thing and there's no one? And I just said, God, I'm giving it over to you now. You're going to need to handpick the people that are going to be in the space. And I'm telling you, Lee, everyone that was there was everyone that needed to be there because the energy of those founders, the way they supported each other, the way they were excited, the way they were grateful, the way that they gave me feedback every single day around how this shop is changing their lives is exactly what needed to happen for them. Mm-hmm. And I always went into it wanting to empower them, but also wanting to see if this could be another revenue stream for the business. And everything fell into place. The energy of the space, I was very intentional. I said, I wanted to feel like home. It was everything I said I wanted to be. We made a lot of money for the founders and for ourselves. There was never a day where we sat and we were like, oh, no one has come in. From the minute we opened the doors in the morning till the time that we closed, people were walking in, people were coming back, people were excited. People were like, whose shop is this? And I were like, and I went there every day because I wanted to see what people are saying and to see what they gravitate towards and what they like. And all people, all walks of life, black, white, male, female, it did so much for the brand. It did so much for me in understanding the impact that we're making in the community and people walking in and saying, oh, I've been following from this point. It was a shift. It was a turning point for me as much as it was for the founders. You know, they still email me to this day saying, you showed us how the potential of our brand. When people were buying our brand without knowing us, when people were coming into the shop and picking up our products on the basis that they're beautiful and nothing else, that is something we had never experienced because our community was buying from us, but we were not reaching other communities. I've always said, I want a gender woman to sell everything to women. Anything I think about, we have a solid case as a brand that says, oh yeah, a gender woman, it makes sense. Because that's what a brand is. It's about building a narrative that lands with people so well that they start thinking about things that you can do. It's in their lives now. It's in their minds. They understand it.
They live with it.
They see what I saw 5 years ago because of all the work that we've done to get here.
Nomdeni, you know, there's so many people who, like, everybody has this thing where they, not everybody, but people often go on about how, oh, one day when I release my life book and, you know, and I mean, I know a lot of people who have these great lives and they could release books, right? They could write books, have them published. You know, if you write a book, I'm literally the first person to go out and buy that book because I feel like the way that the truth of your journey, the way that you eloquently describe it, the vulnerability, the highs, the lows, and there's so many other things we didn't touch on. I feel that whether you're male, whether you're female, whether you're African, whether you're not African, whether you're young, whether you're old, whether you've been in business for many years, whether you're thinking about going into business, whether you're in corporate, whether you're a mother, whether you're recently divorced, whatever it is, there is something in Nomdeni's story that is going to touch you in a way and you're going to walk away with that nugget. The whole world is going to know everything that you're doing because I feel like the purpose that you have, I mean, in everything that you do, perhaps the secret sauce is the fact that it's never really about you. It's never, you know, there's always other people who are benefiting from it. And that's what we don't understand. And I think it's been great. Even the way that you spoke about speaking to yourself and, you know, dealing with ego and everything. Those are very real conversations that we need to have, having the courage to do what you do and for walking this journey.
2024 and everything that we'll get to do. One of the things I'm really excited about is housing some of the brands that are in Accra, brands that are in Toronto, female founded brands that want to have access to the South African market, being part of Agenda Woman Brand & Co. I think for me, that's one of the most exciting things for 2024, being able to just bring all the the people of color, particularly women, into the space. And everyone in South Africa has already been emailing me saying, oh, now that you have this, can you get this brand from this influencer in Toronto or from that influencer in Accra? Can you house it? Can you reach out to them? And it gives me so much joy to be able to create that community where people can benefit from this thing that we built from, you know, just wanting a conversation with 20 girls. And now we're going to impact someone who's in, because that's an international footprint that we start to help those people build by landing in Africa and landing in South Africa as well. Mm. So it's really exciting, the potential for the brand, even for me sitting and just watching it grow. It's like watching your child, right? And you're just like, okay, I think with this one, I can see what's going to happen. I can relax now with this one. I don't have to be too hard on them. So sitting in that position is just so, it's humbling. I will never discount the grace that I see over my life. I will never discount the way that I see God leading in my life. And I will always be grateful that I was given a heart where I can listen and follow and get out of my head. And I think my 20s were about getting me there so that they can get me out quickly and very harshly. Yeah. But I will always be grateful that it happened quickly. And I'm coming into this year where I'm turning 40, and I'm extremely excited and very confident and rooted in what I believe the rest of my life is going to be, which is absolutely amazing.
Absolutely amazing. Thank you so much, Nomdeni Mdaki, for I could speak to you for hours, but thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. This was fun.
Because Lee, what it taught me is people will tell you what they know you want to hear.
Yeah.
They won't tell you what they think you should hear to prepare yourself for the worst.
When you don't stop and look back where you come from, you don't realize how much you have done. And we don't give ourselves enough credit as human beings. Because it takes a lot for me to say, I'm waking up, I'm going to do it again.
The pursuit of perfection is really one of our biggest enemies, right? Waiting till this thing is absolutely perfect before I release it into the world. So when I lost my father, I was like, I'm not waiting for perfection. It's done. The book is done. It's good enough. I'm releasing it into the world.